right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And this is going to be a hell of a show. I really like this one. You know, November 22nd, it's the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, right? And really, it's really very, very interesting to see how history changes, how history actually is reinterpreted to paint completely different and wrong pictures of what actually happened and what actually was going on. And you don't have to look long in the mainstream press today to find sentences like this. Despite holding office for less than a full term, he has long been perceived by the U.S. public as one of the best occupants of the White House. Okay, and that's describing, yes, Kennedy. And there's a big question out here. You know, there's a big question out here because then you look at Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone came in the mail yesterday, and I opened it up, and there it is. What is it? It's a big article. JFK's Vision of Peace. And it's by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's supposedly recalling the fallen president's attempts to end the Cold War and promote peace throughout the world. You know, what's the truth? We're going to get into that today. How and why did Kennedy become president? What did he do during his time in office? And what was the impact on the people here in the U.S. and Latin America and Vietnam and around the world? What did he do about civil rights, segregation, and the oppression of black people? This is something that's extremely important to get into. And I'm going to open, you know what, Teddy? I'm going to open the show up. I'm going to open up the discussion with play track two. I want to get about a minute or so of track two, and that'll set the stage for maybe a little bit, maybe 2 minutes of track two, and that'll set the stage for my guest to talk with us all about all this, C. Clark Kissinger. Clark is an author, activist, and manager of Revolution Books. And we're going to listen to this little bit of music to sort of put us in the Kennedy years. Okay, Teddy, take it away.
Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret. Silver wings upon their chest, these are men, America's best. 100 men will test today, but only 3 win the Green Beret. Trained to live.
All right, all right. The Ballad of the Green Berets, and that sets us, I think that sets a the right context for talking about Kennedy and what he did for U.S. imperialism around the world. So as I said, joining us to talk about all this is Clark Kissinger. Clark, how are you?
Very good, Michael, and happy to be on your show.
Good, good. Well, you're most welcome. And that Green Berets, I hope you didn't see a whole pile of people out there rushing out to join the military or, you know, get their wings. But that
it was a signature piece of the Kennedy administration, though, and he made a special trip down to Fort Bragg in North Carolina to bestow the Green Berets on the special forces because his administration was one that characterized a major shift in U.S. military policy away from massive nuclear attack on the Soviet Union to dealing with counterinsurgency and national revolutions in the Third World.
Well, let's get into this a little bit deeper. Let's situate Kennedy in the overall scene in the world back then.
Well, it's important to look at both the international situation and the domestic situation. The mid-50s, or the period of like the Eisenhower administration, there were several things that were going on that were very important. One was this was a period of enormous capital expansion for the United States. The U.S. had come out of World War II. With the majority of the productive capability of the world and certainly the vast majority of the world's gold reserves. They were also embarked on a policy of scarfing up the colonies in England, France, and the Netherlands. And the only thing that sort of stood in its way was the socialist bloc, because there was, for a period of time there, 2 major socialist countries, the Soviet Union and China. And by the way, I really want to recommend the current issue of Revolution newspaper, which is a special double issue that actually goes into this whole history, which is so very significant. People sort of forget about that there was a period in history when one-third of humanity did not live its lives subordinate to the accumulation of private capital. So that was a big deal. And the third thing was these wars of national liberation that were taking place. Not everybody wanted to be handed off from their previous colonial masters to the neo-colonial masters of the United States. However, there was another thing that happened at that point, too, that was very, very significant, and that was the collapse and the death of socialism in the Soviet Union. And people remember today, they talk about the 20th Party Congress and Khrushchev's secret speech about Stalin, but actually the major thing that happened at that Congress was the adoption of a whole new policy of the three peacefuls that were characteristic of the shift from socialism to capitalist competition with the United States. I mean, he spelled it out, you know, peaceful coexistence, peaceful competition, and peaceful transition to socialism. But that also meant that the United States was not confronted with exactly the same kind of threat that had been ballyhooed for many years of the potential of a great nuclear war with the Soviet Union. Rather, the problem was one of proxy wars in the Soviet Union aiding insurgent movements in the Third World. And Kennedy's military advisor was Maxwell Taylor, who was a sharp guy who was kind of ahead of the curve here and understood that the problem was not amassing more nuclear weapons. And, you know, this was the period of, you know, the U.S. was going to bomb the Soviet Union of smithereens that's satirized in Dr. Strangelove. But the Kennedy administration represented, they were ahead of the curve. They actually understood what was needed here in forms of wars in the Third World and counterinsurgency. They were very sharp imperialists, you might say. And so this is this formation of the Green Berets, the special forces, the sending of the first military advisors to Vietnam, and conducting all kinds of counterinsurgency operations in Latin America is one of the things that characterized the Kennedy administration.
You know, Clark, just to step back for a minute, a little bit, because it's also true. I mean, I'm listening to what you're saying, and it's true on this in terms of the being really a fighter to push out the U.S. imperialists to what he considered their rightful place in the world, to go up against whatever attempts were being made, you know, through competitor imperialists, especially after the coup in the Soviet Union. But even then, there was a point here where Kennedy was well steeped in this whole idea, this whole sense of, and I think what you were saying, you know, if you look at it in terms of what existed in the world at the time, the socialist countries, you know, that were in existence, you know, China and Russia until 1956, but you had this thing where Kennedy was actually, he was a staunch anti-communist for quite some time. He saw that really as a major threat to the interests of U.S. imperialism around the world and internally. I mean, isn't that true?
Oh, yes. In fact, one of the things that people forget about today is that his father, Joseph Kennedy, who was rumored to be a little soft on Hitler in World War II, but was very anti-communist and was a major supporter of Senator Joseph McCarthy from Wisconsin. He had McCarthy up to vacation with them at their home at Hyannisport, and McCarthy actually hired Bobby Kennedy to be his chief staff person on his Senate investigation committees when he was doing the anti-communist witch hunts. Bobby Kennedy was his chief. That was Bobby Kennedy's start in public legal stuff, was being McCarthy's right-hand man in the investigations. So Kennedy was very steeped in that, and it came up a lot of times. It came up around the March on Washington in 1963, when the Kennedy administration actually opposed that march happening, and when they realized that they couldn't stop it, they had a meeting in the White House to try and cool it down and block certain people from speaking, and Kennedy actually took Martin Luther King on a little private walk in the Rose Garden and basically told him, look, you can go ahead with the march, but you've got to get rid of a couple people around SCLC who have a long history with the old Communist Party. So he, you know, that was his mindset in all of this.
Now, he also didn't take part in a vote to censure McCarthy, right? Is that what happened?
Well, what happened on that is also interesting, because Bobby had been working for McCarthy, and because his old man was a big supporter of McCarthy, he went into the hospital. He had many medical problems, Addison's disease and a back problem, and he was absent from the Senate when the vote to censure McCarthy was taken. Now, he could have, as people often do when they're absent from a vote like that, pair themselves with somebody else who's going to be absent from the other side as a way of indicating how they would vote on it. But he never did that, and he never indicated that he would or how he would have voted on the motion to censure McCarthy.
Mm-hmm. You know, it reminds me, actually, it's one thing I was thinking of earlier that I wanted to sort of open this up with. You know, there's a quote from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, that I think sort of has to set somewhat of the tone that we're talking about here today. You know, in terms of what has been reported about Kennedy, I think it's extremely important to get a grasp on this. You know, the idea that liberals have an Oedipal complex. It's not that they want to sleep with their mothers. It's that they willfully blind themselves. And there's way too much willful blinding going on. You know, people poking their own eyes out, and it's time for them to take the pins out of their eyes and look at what really happened, what's real in history and what isn't. And it's important because we have to understand what's needed today and what we're going to do today. Now, the other thing, Clark, I wanted to ask you about, you kept hinting about Vietnam and the Green Berets. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about Kennedy's involvement in Vietnam, because, again, one of the things that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. points out is he says, well, but the day before he was assassinated, he was talking about, we got to get out of this war. We got to get out of this. I never would have, never should have gone on, you know, going into it. What's the truth about Kennedy in Vietnam?
Well, I don't think that the record supports that. I mean, he was somebody from the very beginning who wanted to stop any revolutionary movements in Vietnam. If you recall what happened after the first war against the French that took place after World War II, there was a conference that was held in Geneva in 1954, and the country was temporarily divided into two military regroupment zones, and there was supposed to be national elections for a single government for all of Vietnam. But the United States blocked that and set up a regime in South Vietnam headed by a Catholic Vietnamese named Diem, who was very much tied in with the Kennedys at the beginning. His wife, Madame Nu, made this famous trip to the United States. But in the end, when he didn't pan out correctly and didn't handle the rebellion of the Buddhist monks who began emulating themselves in opposition to this, the United States, under Kennedy, had him assassinated. The Kennedy's man on the spot, Averell Harriman, actually directed the whole coup that took place in 1963, assassinated Diem and brought a different Vietnamese general in there. But Kennedy's administration presided over sending the first military advisors there, began sending the military equipment, and wanted to continue and make sure that there was no expansion of the liberation movement in Southeast Asia into Vietnam. I mean, I think this idea that he was really wanted to get out and leave is kind of wishful thinking, and nor was there any change in the in this at all in the successor administration, Lyndon Johnson, which kept on a lot of the same team. Maxwell Taylor was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Bobby Kennedy continued on for a period of time as Attorney General, and there was no change. If anything, the continued expansion of the war took place.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Clark Kissinger. Clark is an author, activist, and I should say, too, Clark is also one of the founders of Students for Democratic Society, SDS. Way back then, Clark was walking the walk, okay? He's talking from some direct experience, but he's also talking about as someone who was going up against the system. And SDS, for people who don't know, the Students for Democratic Society, became one of the major revolutionary organizations among students in the U.S. Back in the 60s. Now, Clark, one of the things that I wanted to talk about in terms of this, you know, it's interesting because I'm looking at something that comes from Howard Zinn's People's History of the U.S., and he made a point that in 1960, the military budget was $45.8 billion. And it was 49% of the total budget. And as soon as Kennedy came into office, he used all kinds of rhetoric about so-called missile gaps and bomber gaps and all this stuff, which apparently were not really true, in order to increase the military budget by $9 billion, about 20%. We're talking as soon as he came into office. This is hardly the dove looking for a place to land.
Well, there's two different aspects of that. One is he did use the phony missile gap as one of his campaign points when he was running against Nixon. He's actually tried to get to the right of Nixon. on this issue and saying that the United States was falling behind the Soviet Union in the development of intercontinental ballistic missiles, which turned out to be absolutely false. And I think he actually knew it at the time, but it was a campaign rhetoric. When he came into office, the military budget expanded greatly, but in part, this was the expansion of conventional forces. I mean, the Republicans had followed a policy of more bang for the buck, which means keep a balanced budget and do this on the cheap by building hydrogen bombs. Kennedy understood that you actually needed to expand and this was Maxwell Taylor's contribution, that the United States actually needed to expand its conventional forces to be able to deal with these movements in the Third World. So that's one of the reasons why there was a great expansion. The other thing is that the Minuteman missiles were in place during Kennedy's administration. This was something that began, was a program that was actually launched under the Eisenhower administration, but Kennedy certainly carried it through, and there were probably more intercontinental ballistic missiles put in place during Kennedy's administration than the administration of any other president.
Aha! Okay. The devil, you say. He is a man of peace. Listen, one of the things I want to, let's move on a little bit because I know we want to take listener callers towards the back end of the show, but I want to talk about Cuba. You can't talk about Kennedy without talking about Cuba. So let's dig into that. There's, and as I see it, there's like three things, the Bay of Pigs, the missile crisis, and then all the, you know, the continuing sort of terrorist war against Castro that went on in the aftermath of all that.
Right. It was called Operation Mongoose. And that was the plan to and the different attempts to assassinate Castro that continued. The Bay of Pigs invasion had actually been planned under the Eisenhower administration. Certainly, Kennedy had an option to stop it if he had wanted to, but he obviously didn't want to, and it was allowed to run its course. Of course, it was ignominiously defeated, and the United States had to, in essence, pay reparations. If you recall, what happened is the United States gave medical aid and stuff like that to Vietnam in exchange for having the prisoners of the Bay of Pigs invasion repatriated to the United States. After that, then, though, the Soviet Union began to emplace missiles in Cuba, and this is when Kennedy leaped forward. And there's kind of like two aspects to this, his reputation on this. One is he stopped Soviet aggression against the United States and this dangerous threat, and the other is he averted a nuclear war by backing down Khrushchev and saving the world, so to speak. Now, one of the things that people forget or don't know about even is that while the Soviet Union implanted some missiles 90 miles off United States soil, the U.S. had missiles 0 miles off the Soviet Union's soil. The United States had nuclear-tipped missiles in Turkey, which borders on the Soviet Union, aimed at the Soviet Union. It had nuclear missiles in Italy, also aimed at the Soviet Union. And most people believe today that they had them in Japan also, although because of the anti-nuclear clause in the and the anti-nuclear feeling in Japan, that they never officially admitted that they had them there. So in other words, what the United States was complaining about was what the United States was already doing to the Soviet Union. So there was this big showdown around it and threats of war, and it actually was a very scary time. I remember it, and one of the claims that Kennedy made at that point was that putting these missiles in Cuba was a violation of the United Nations Charter. And there's this very interesting point in Bob Avakian's memoir where he read that, and he went down to the library to read the United Nations Charter to find out, you know, like, was there some clause in it saying the Soviet Union shall not put missiles in Cuba? Well, of course, it was a total fraud. There was no violation of the United Nations Charter that was involved at all, any more so than the United States putting the missiles in Turkey and Italy. So what people also don't know about this is that there was a behind-the-scenes deal on it, that if the Soviet Union removed the missiles from Cuba, the United States would, in turn, remove the missiles from Turkey, which, in fact, they did. So Kennedy came off smelling like violets on this, like he had averted a nuclear war and that he had backed down the Soviet Union. But in the end, the United States had to remove its missiles from Turkey. But this was dangerous stuff. I mean, there's several times, both in the 50s and the 60s, when the imperialists could have thrown the world into a nuclear war.
Well, you know, I remember reading something, and I had this person on the show, and it slips my mind right now in terms of who it was. But I had this person on the show who wrote a book about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And one of the interesting things he pointed out was he pointed out how actually just fanatical and vigorous the Kennedys were, especially Bobby Kennedy, but John Kennedy as well, in terms of this point about the nuclear showdown. I mean, the missiles that were lined up and aimed at Cuba and all this other stuff. This was, and there was a massive invasion plan too. There were hundreds of thousands of troops that they were trying to line up to push into Cuba as well. You know, you think about this, this was really a very, very tight spot at that time. And it was a place where somebody like Kennedy, you know, went one way or the other in terms of, and his decision was based not on some kind of mythical liberal love of peace and humanity, but it was based on what was going on with U.S. imperialism in the world at that point.
Right, and what was best for U.S. imperialism. I mean, whenever we use the terms liberal and conservative, we have to remember that those two words are adjectives that modify the noun imperialist. So there are these policy differences that take place at all times, like can this problem with the missiles in Cuba be resolved diplomatically? Can it be resolved through an embargo? Should we invade? These are policy differences that went on. But it's absolutely true that a large section of the cabinet and the military wanted to do a full-scale invasion and use this as the pretext to take Cuba out.
Now, one thing that always comes up in relation to this is the CIA and the idea, and I'm not talking about conspiracy theories or any of this, but the idea that somehow the CIA and Kennedy were at odds with one another after the Bay of Pigs and throughout the whole Cuban Missile Crisis and everything that happened after that. What do you know about that?
Very little. I don't want to make up stuff, you know, where I don't know it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, the CIA was something that was an agency that was always identified with the Eastern establishment. A lot of their key people had come out of Princeton and Yale and so forth. They were seen almost as a global instrument of old money and of the a certain segment of the ruling class in this country, and they were not seen as manly and aggressive as the conventional armed forces, and certainly not as much as the Strategic Air Command and its willingness to bomb Vietnam or bomb the Soviet Union back into the Stone Age, as they were always talking about doing during that period of time. There doesn't seem to be any reason to believe that there was some fallout or difference, though, between Kennedy and the CIA. There are all many conspiracy theories, of course, around Kennedy's assassination. And it's one of the things that's interesting is, you know, the House of Representatives did convene what they call the Select Committee on Assassinations in 1978, I believe it was, to look again at the assassination of Kennedy and of Martin Luther King. And that committee actually concluded that the assassination of Kennedy was most likely the result of a conspiracy, but they didn't say by whom, and they sealed their records for 50 years.
Huh. Okay. Tick tock, tick tock, tick tock.
Right.
Okay. Well, let's jump ahead a little bit here. One of the signature programs that Kennedy developed was the Alliance for Progress. Let's talk about that. What it was, and where it came from, what its impact was.
Well, the Alliance for Progress was basically supposedly to be an economic development plan for Latin America, and the United States was going to put up some capital, and the countries of Latin America were challenged to put up capital and develop their economies. But basically, this was a cover for the economic penetration of U.S. capital into Latin America, in a certain sense, a precursor of NAFTA, of trying to bring all of this. This was a period of enormous capital expansion of the United States globally, and Latin America was certainly one of the places that it went into. And although it was ballyhooed around economic development, the principal thing that happened during the years of the Alliance for Progress is the vast expansion of military aid into Latin America, or aid's really not the right word for it. What was going on prior to that time is that the U.S. policy with regard to these countries had revolved around what was known as hemispheric defense. That is, how to defend the New World if we were attacked by outside powers. It shifted from that to one of counterinsurgency and domestic domestic security. And also during the years of the Alliance for Progress, the number of military regimes that came to power in Latin America greatly increased. I don't have the figures right at my fingertips, but there was actually a move away from elected governments into coups and things like the overthrow of the Goulart government in 1960, I believe it was, in Brazil, and so on. So, you know, the Peace Corps was kind of the other signature project during that time that would to put a smiley face on what the U.S. was doing in the world.
I think William Blum actually has, he counted up about 6 coups in Latin America during the Kennedy administration.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's 6 military coups that overthrew popular regimes during those years, and 10 right. more later that were, like, you know, linked to what was done during the Kennedy administration. And in several cases, Kennedy's policies contributed materially to the outcome, as well as just sort of politically, you know. So it's a pretty heavy scene when you think about what's going on there. And that idea that the military, regrouped from refocused from its hemispheric protective kind of thing and what it was doing in terms of protecting the borders of these various countries to actually much more this role of internal repression is pretty heavy when you think about it.
It is. But again, then you see that Kennedy is no different than any other president. I mean, the president of the United States is the commander-in-chief of the empire, from Kennedy, you know, down to Obama today. And that's what they're tasked with. But there is this attempt. I know you opened the show by quoting one of the something that appeared in the media today. There's a big op-ed piece in the New York Times today entitled, "What Made Kennedy Great?" And when you dig into it, what they say is, Kennedy's greatest success was the thing that his detractors often criticize, his charisma, his feel for the importance of inspirational leadership, and his willingness to use it for great ends. And compared with other recent presidents whose stumbles and failures have assaulted the national self-esteem, memories of Kennedy continue to give the country faith that its better days are ahead. It's all appearance and without actually digging into the substance of it.
Yeah, and it's aiding people in that willful blinding themselves that I think that they had mentioned. You know, one thing I wanted to, before we move out of the Alliance for Progress, and I know we're running through this very quickly, let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Clark Kissinger. He's author, activist, former, one of the founders of Students for Democratic Society in the 1960s. He was deeply involved in the revolutionary upsurges of the 1960s in this country. And we're talking about the truth about Kennedy and U.S. imperialism and the relationship between them, who he served and who he didn't serve. Now, Clark, one thing before we move out of the Alliance for Progress, there is also this point, and I think I read this, in American Decline by Raymond Lotta, this point about that a big part of what was going on in relation to the Alliance for Progress was they had to counter somehow, and you know, the growing influence of Cuba throughout Latin America, which was another aspect of this whole thing.
Cuba and China. I mean, the revolutionary movement in Peru that started very early was inspired by China, as were several others. I mean, it was this was an era of where the principal contradiction in the world was between imperialism headed up by the United States principally and these movements of liberation in the Third World. That was what characterized what was going on globally and driving things forward, certainly up till at least the late 70s. So that in this period of time, this was the context in which Kennedy was and his principal military advisor, Maxwell Taylor. By the way, Maxwell Taylor not only was served as a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but then became the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam. I mean, in a certain sense, the Vietnam War was kind of a signature piece in the sense that they wanted to demonstrate that a war of national liberation could be defeated. Because the great fear that they had was that a little country somewhere might fall into the hands of the people who live there. And if they could put on this demonstration that wars of national liberation can be defeated, it wasn't like the United States was making great profits out of investments in Vietnam. There was bigger fish to fry, you know, on a global level.
Mm-hmm. And just before we move into one more subject, or actually maybe we'll take a break after this and come back to talk about this next subject, but I wanted to actually raise to you this quote from Noam Chomsky again, this excerpt from, basically it was from Rethinking Camelot. And he talks about a guy named, and I'll probably mispronounce his name, but Charles Meshling, who led counterinsurgency and internal defense planning for the U.S. from 1961 to 1966. And he said that the historic decision around the change in the military strategies in Latin America. The military mission of the Latin American military, from hemispheric defense to internal security, led to a change from toleration of the rapacity and cruelty of the Latin American military to direct complicity in the methods of Heinrich Himmler's extermination squads. That's a pretty heavy statement.
But when you see it come to fruition in the Reagan years under Rios Montt in Guatemala and the extermination of the indigenous people there, you see that that's exactly what it was.
Well, Clark, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll talk with you about the Kennedy and the struggle of black people here in the U.S., and we're going to come right back after this break. Welcome back. That's All Blues from the Rebirth Brass Band, all right? Yeah, that's right, a cover of All Blues. There you go. That kind of sets the stage for the rest of the show. Clark, welcome back.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You know, one more area I wanted to cover, and that is, as I was saying before we went out for the break, Kennedy and the struggle of black people in the U.S. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, one of the things you need to remember is that Kennedy was elected on the basis of the New Deal coalition, which was the bringing together of the Irish Catholic machines of the northern urban cities, the southern white supremacist governments of the southern states, and this coalition of them and to some degree organized labor. Was what Roosevelt had put together. And this coalition still was the heart of the Democratic Party. So when Kennedy was elected, he was elected with the solid South voting for him. You look at these electoral maps, you know, just overwhelmingly. And this is a period when blacks were virtually totally excluded from voting in the South. So white Southern people voted for Kennedy in spite of his being Catholic. He carried these northern urban machine areas. And he carried what was left of organized labor, all part of this coalition. But so this did not actually, in a certain sense, portend well for black people in America who were raising their heads at this time. He came in just at the moment that the sit-in movement was starting in the South. And one of the promises that he made during his election campaign, yeah, I don't know, it was just a off-the-cuff remark, but he said that he could, you know, if he was elected, with a stroke of a pen, eliminate segregation in public-funded public housing. And so he was elected. Nothing happened. You know, everybody's waiting for the stroke of the pen. Finally, some of the civil rights organizations started organizing a campaign to mail pens to him. And this actually became a small phenomenon of people mailing pens to the White House for him to make the gesture. It was 2 years before he did anything on segregation in public funded housing, and even then it was only half step measures, and public housing remained, and to a large degree to this day remains racially segregated. The other thing is that he was kind of notorious for appointing really bad racist judges in the South. Again, this is a part of this coalition deal. He depended in the Senate and in particularly for the votes of the Southern white senators down there, and they basically exercised a veto power over the selection of federal judges in the South. So some of the worst judges in this period of time of the burgeoning civil rights movement were actually appointed by Kennedy. And then when the Freedom Rides take place in 61, it must have been 61, to integrate interstate transportation, which theoretically was under the federal jurisdiction, the federal government, first of all, under Kennedy's administration, attempted behind the scenes to stop it from happening. There was a documentary that appeared on public television a year or so ago on the history of the Freedom Rides, and they talked about getting calls from the Justice Department asking them, please don't do this. But they refused to back down, and they went forward with it. And then the FBI, under Bobby Kennedy's direction, basically stood around and watched white mobs terrorize and beat and seriously injure people who went. It's a miracle no one was killed on the Freedom Rides themselves, and do nothing. And the same thing gets repeated in the Selma March and so on, the attack of the people on the Pettus Bridge when they're marching the March to Montgomery that took place. There was just a pattern here of the refusal to do anything in the Kennedy administration. It really wasn't until in the Johnson years when the bombing took place and they killed the four little girls in Birmingham, and vast nighttime demonstrations started taking place in Birmingham and the first of the urban insurrections also takes place in 1964, that they decided they actually had to do something. But basically, Kennedy stonewalled the stuff.
One of the things that, you know, when you said the four little girls, what were we talking about there, just so people know?
Well, there was a bombing of this church in Birmingham, Alabama, by segregationist terrorists, and blew up a bomb outside the church on Sunday, and four young girls were killed, four young black girls. And it was one of these seminal events in the civil rights movement that changed the whole character of what was going on, but the inaction was just palpable inaction during the Kennedy years from the national government, when at the same time these white terrorists were just running rampant in the South.
Right. You know, I remember seeing that film on the Freedom Riders, and it was very moving when Diane Nash, a young student, a Nashville College student, and a SNCC leader, and she basically said that, you know, we're not going to allow the Freedom Rides to be halted. And they got their buses and they pushed out. They went on to get it. And then I remember that comment, apparently, you know, where Kennedy, one of his spokespeople was there. And when he reported to Kennedy that this woman, Diane Nash, was saying that they're going to go ahead and have this. And he said, who the hell is Diane Nash?
You know, and it's good. Right. And the other thing is, she in that same documentary, he I can't remember the name of the guy who was calling from the Justice Department, said, you know, one of you is liable to be killed. And she says, "Yes, we've been writing out our wills."
That reminds me of the thing that James Farmer was dealing with when Kennedy was talking mm-hmm. about go slow, cool out in the middle of all this. And Farmer said, "We've been cooling out for 350 years, man. We can't continue on that path." I'm going to interrupt here with a special message to people who are listening to the show now. If you are listening to the show now, please don't try to call. This show was pre-recorded, and if you try to call, you're only going to get frustrated because this is all happening, sometime before you're listening to it. So there is a lot in the questions and answers, and I'm sure you'll really enjoy it. If you want to write to me and formulate your opinion and questions, you can write to me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. But please don't try to call because this show is pre-recorded. Give us a call now. Agree, disagree, want to add more to the pot? Throw it in. Join in the conversation. Join in the discussion. Let's talk to Tony on line one. Tony, how are you?
Hello. Yes, it's Tony Taylor from Long Beach. Here's what I want to add to the pot to you and your guest. Yes, I agree with everything you're saying, but I think it has to be more nuanced. You can't go extreme either way. Camelot, this Pollyannic view, nor Kennedy being total like every other president. Remember, here's a historical analog. FDR and Yitzhak Rabin. FDR was the head of the empire, Yitzhak of Zionism. But he was also killed. Yitzhak Rabin was killed by right-wing vigilantes of the extreme group who thought he didn't go far enough. When FDR gave some concession, the upper class tried to take him out with Smedley Butler. So here's my point in regards to Kennedy. He started to realize that the U.S. would be too deeply mired in a war they couldn't get out, so he tried to do more fascist counterinsurgency operations than the big military expenditures. That got him into problems. So it's a little more nuanced than what you're saying.
Clark?
I agree in part, but the fundamental thing is that who this person represented, Kennedy represented. He was put forward and is still hailed as some kind of man of the people and visionary, and he was, in fact, a continuing defender of the empire, dealing with new freedoms and necessities that had come into existence at the time that he assumed the presidency.
I agree, but here's my point, though. My point is the fact that he realized, Kennedy, like FDR realized, there are people above you, meaning FDR and Kennedy, who are total fanatics. And Kennedy was a little more pragmatic, as FDR was, saying to the upper class, if you don't give some concessions, you're going to lose everything. The crazies under FDR, over FDR, and the crazies over Kennedy took him out. And they tried to take out FDR the same way. So Kennedy was a Cold War warrior, but he was not just like everybody else. He tried to be a little more pragmatic, but they still took him out.
Well, the problem, though, is that you're hard-pressed to think of concessions that Kennedy actually made. Concessions really weren't made until the mid-60s when these mass popular movements took to the street.
Well, the concession was the Alliance for Progress. It was a pressure valve because he knew, like Kennedy said, those who make peaceful revolutionary impossible make violent revolutionary inevitable. So it was a ploy to offset the national liberation movements in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, because the upper class wanted to take everything. And Kennedy said to those guys, if you don't give them something, then the liberation movements will harm our profits. So there were many concessions, but they killed him anyway. He wasn't hard enough.
All right, Tony, we'll talk. Well, thanks for calling, but take Clark's thoughts offline, and then we'll move to our next caller. Any comment, Clark, on that last statement?
Yeah, I just still don't see the concessions, and I don't see the Alliance for Progress as being a concession. It was basically a subsidy for U.S. investment into Latin America.
And again, let's not forget the Heinrich Himmler point. I mean, there's a point here where, look, some of the most fascistic regimes that have existed in South America, in Latin America as a whole, South America, Central America, came directly out of the Alliance for Progress and the reorientation of the military to domestic repression. This is a very heavy point when you think about that. The Guatemala death squads, the Salvadoran death squads, all this coming up out of that. Let's move on to, let's talk to Bella on line two. Bella, how are you?
Hey, Michael, thank you so very much for opening up the lines. I appreciate what the analysis that's been laid in front of us. Very real. I was born in the Dominican Republic, and this is being not covered. The Caribbean islands suffered a great deal. As far as I'm concerned, which I published on my website in 2004, every U.S. president has been a criminal, and there is no letting up. By the way, the first socialist elected to the city council in Seattle, Shawna Swant, I mean, it's just incredible. So hope is still out there. We just got to keep fighting. Communism, socialism, I see it as a vanguard. And so let's cover the Dominican Republic, because the Dominican Republic has always been under control of the United States Empire. And under the dictatorship of Trujillo, I was born.
All right, Bella, we'll have Clark speak to that. Thank you very much for calling today. Clark, what about the Dominican Republic and Kennedy and the Democrats?
Well, you see, the best example of it is when, after Lyndon Johnson ran as the peace candidate in 1964 and was elected, virtually his first act in office was the invasion of the Dominican Republic in the early spring of 1965.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to line three. And Gordon, Gordon, how are you?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Can you touch on the subject of, because you might have talked about it, but everybody seems to be sliding Kennedy out of Vietnam, saying that, oh, he was, you know, definitely trying to get us out. And yet, I remember, if not correct, he's the one who hired McNamara and most of those people who basically led Johnson into, according to David Hobson, into a more militant stance in Vietnam.
All right, Clark?
Well, we did talk about that earlier. I mean,
yeah.
Kennedy really was the architect of the U.S. intervention in Vietnam. McNamara comes in under Johnson, but the people like Maxwell Taylor and Averill Harriman and Cabot Lodge, who Kennedy sent to deal with things in Vietnam, were staunch cold warriors who wanted to they wanted to see a war there, and they wanted to see the United States victorious, and they wanted to see any example of a national war of liberation be defeated.
All right, Gordon, we're going to have to move on to the next call, but thank you for calling today. Let's go to Lewis on line four. Lewis, how are you?
Very interesting discussion this morning. You know, I see an analogy between the Kennedy-Nixon election of 1960 and everybody, especially the pundits, expected Nixon to win. Of course, Nixon represented the old traditional cold warriors and the Eastern establishment. And Kennedy came in with new ideas and more a technocratic approach to imperialism, more or less updating it. And the president, when we had Obama and McCain, McCain representing the old guard, and Obama representing the change, which really meant a change in updating the U.S. Imperialism in for this period. So both were able to fool large, you know, numbers of the public. And so I think your program serves to try to expose the nature of the ruling class and the fact that you refer to the president as a chief executive of imperialism, I think is a very, very good characterization of what the presidency represents.
Great, Lewis. So
thank you for your program.
Thank you, man, for listening. All right, and for contributing. All right, Clark, you have any comment on that? Otherwise, we'll move on to another caller.
No, let's go on. Let's get some more callers in.
All right, how about Joseph on line one?
Hello.
Hi, Joseph.
Hi. I just wanted to say real quick that Kennedy was killed in front, out in the open, in front of everybody to make an example of him. They didn't. They could have easily killed him, like they killed so many scientists who come up with free energy devices, like Stanley Meyer, who made a car that ran on water back in the 80s, and he conveniently died of an aneurysm. You know, I don't know if you know about the covert technology they have to do this. They can implant you with chips. They do all sorts of stuff that, you know, only if you're truly awake are you going to know about. But Stanley Meyer made a car ran off of water. They took him out. He's an engineer, and nobody even knows about that, you know. So,
Joseph.
Yeah, they didn't have to take him out in front of everybody. They made an example of him because he was trying to make big changes. Look up Stanley Meyer and be aware that when you do research into these things, the internet is littered with disinformation to make you think it's not true. But these are realities that not everybody gets to.
All right, Joseph, thank you very much. But again, I actually would really encourage people to listen to what's being said during this interview. And you can disagree with it or agree with it, but, you know, there is a point to actually understanding the reality that we've lived, that the planet has lived through, and understanding, you know, what Kennedy's role was, what the role of U.S. imperialism is. And I'm going to read another quote from Bob Avakian, and it's from his book Basics. And I thought that this is something that also should be, people should be mindful about. If you try to make the Democrats be what they are not and never will be, you're going to end up being more like what the Democrats actually are. And that actually is, unfortunately, it's something that we see going on time and time again. Let's move on to Carlos on line two. Carlos, how are you?
Yes, very well. Well, listen, there were many factions that really wanted to kill Kennedy. He fired Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA. So he antagonized the CIA, but he was also starting to print his own green money to the U.S. Treasury, independent of the powerful forces behind the Federal Reserve Board. And, of course, he wanted to bring the troops back from Vietnam, which would have antagonized the corporate banking establishment. But there's one other reason that very few people touch upon. He was having correspondence with Ben-Gurion of Israel, and he made a point to Ben-Gurion, I'm going to be making inspections on your nuclear power development, your nuclear weapon development. And, of course, right after that, 3 months later, he was dead. I mean, I have a feeling, or a lot of evidence points toward the involvement of Mossad from Israel, Herman Dax, involved in Kennedy's death. I think there was a primary force behind it. And let's not forget that the corporate banking establishment has very strong ties with Israel. So there you go. There is what I think is the smoking gun there behind Kennedy's death.
All right, Carlos, thank you very much. Clark, let's talk about this just a little bit. I'd like to talk about the relationship between the U.S. and Israel under the Kennedy administration.
That's actually something I am not quite as up to speed on as I probably should be. But there was a big change that took place after the 1956 war, when England and France and Israel invaded Egypt to seize the Suez Canal. Up prior to that time, the Republican administration had been kind of standoffish towards Israel. And when that happened, and they had also, the going back to the Roosevelt years, the U.S. imperialism had very deep ties with the Saudi regime, which was the principal source of oil in the Middle East at that time. After the 56 war on Egypt, they began to see Israel as in a new light, as a potential gendarme for the United States in the Middle East, as the Shah of Iran actually became too after the coup that the U.S. organized to overthrow the Mossadegh regime there. And through the Kennedy and the Johnson years, the United States became much more involved in the funding and the arming of Israel in that particular role for the United States. We still don't know today all the details of the involvement of the United States in assisting the Israeli government in the development of nuclear weapons. France was initially involved in that aspect of it, but there are several good books out on it that I would encourage people, you know, to dig into. But I wish I could tell you more about it, but I'm that's one area that I'm not that familiar with in the Kennedy years.
All right, now here's a caller who wants to talk about the last subject that we talked about as we were I was interviewing you, is that the civil rights movement. Let's move to Joe on line one. Joe, how are you?
Yes. Good morning. Thank you. Excellent program. But I wanted to say that I really believe that a lot of this went before Kennedy's administration, particularly Truman integrating the military. But particularly one event that occurred, and I wasn't alive, but apparently a young black man was brutally beaten and killed in the South, and his grandmother released his photo.
Emmett Till.
I think that was a watershed moment for people to wake up. And this was a multi-year, multi-generation process. But I think that one incident galvanized a lot of people and woke a lot of people up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was Emmett Till, who was the young man that was beaten to death. And his mother did release the photo and actually had an open casket funeral in Chicago to let people know what these racists had done to her son. Clark, any comment on this?
Yeah, that was in 1955. Of course, that was in the middle of the Eisenhower years. And it was a seminal event, and it was one of those things that showed people that the Dred Scott decision was still alive, that black people had no rights that white people in this country were compelled to recognize. And it was very, very important. But, in terms of this, what took place overall in this period of time, I don't think, just to go back to some of the issues that some of the previous callers had brought up, there is a tendency to look at some of these things that these more savvy imperialists do as granting concessions. They never grant concessions. Sometimes they're forced to give concessions, but in general they're always trying to get ahead of the curve, and they're trying to position themselves in a way that maintains an aura of legitimacy around a regime that really should have no legitimacy at all. I mean, there's nothing about the U.S. empire that people should have any respect for, or people should have any legitimacy in the eyes of anyone, regardless of which of these various imperialists, whether they are the liberal or the conservative stripes, are administering it. And that's what I, call on people today to do, is to think about what the revolutionary alternatives are to it, because this system will not cure itself. There was a program here the other night in New York where one of the speakers on ecology just happened to make a very profound offhand remark when somebody was talking about why couldn't the government just stop this use of fossil fuels, just like they prohibit people from smoking in public places or whatever. He says, you don't understand. These fossil fuels are as embedded in the economy and as fundamental to it today as slavery was in the 1850s.
Yeah, now that's an important point. I want to make one comment, and then we're going to move on to our last call, and we're going to have to make it real quick. But, sure. There is a point to, someone was just reminding me that they thought it would be important to speak about Kennedy and the operation, sort of the containment posture that he took in relation to the struggle of black people, which was very heavy. The first 2.5 years that he, for the first 2 years he was in office, he did very little except try to contain that struggle. And that's an extremely important Absolutely. Point for people to grasp. Yeah. Let's take our last caller, who's Julio, who wants to talk about the Bay of Pigs. Julio, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good, Mike. Thank you. My question is, was the CIA and other, you know, the extreme elements, you know, in the U.S. government, were they angry with Kennedy because he had bombarded, you know, all of Cuba during the Bay of Pigs invasion and he just limited it? You know, could we give Kennedy a little bit of credit for that? I'm not sure.
All right, Clark, real quick, we have about less a minute or so to answer that.
Okay, one of the things that they did do is they had B-24 bombers with Cuban Air Force markings on them fly out of Guatemala, bomb the Cuban Air Force bases a few days before the Bay of Pigs invasion, and land in Florida announcing that they had defected from the Cuban Air Force. I mean, so it isn't like the United States government did not covertly. They did almost everything they could covertly without involving directly U.S. armed forces as such in that invasion. I don't know who was mad at who in terms. There's always people are mad at each other when their plans don't work. And in this case, the imperialist plans did not work.
All right, Clark Kissinger, author, activist, former member, one of the founders of SDS, and a supporter of the Revolutionary Communist Party, manager of Revolution Books in New York City. Clark, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, take care now. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And we've been talking with Clark Kissinger, author, activist, one of the founding members of the Students for a Democratic Society back in the 1960s, the revolutionary student organization that existed then, and he's the manager of Revolution Books in New York City. And we've been talking about Kennedy. What's the reality behind the myth, okay? What was Kennedy, a man of the people or a representative of imperialism, all right? And so I want to thank Clark for joining us today. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Nellish Lalani and Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. And each and every one of you, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. If you want to follow me on Facebook and Twitter, please do so. And if you want to like us on Facebook, it'll really help, because I'm desperately trying to attain the right number of likes that will open the secret door to superpowers. And you and me and all of us together can move on to conquer the world. All right, well, let's end with those two quotes from Bob Avakian, just so they're fresh in everybody's mind. Liberals have an Oedipal complex. It's not that they want to sleep with their mothers. It's that they willfully blind themselves. And if you try to make the Democrats be what they are not and never will be, you will end up being more like what the Democrats actually are. All right, we're going to go out now with a song that seems really appropriate for today's show. Stand from Sly and the Family Stone. Talk to you again next week.
Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
There's a midget standing tall,
and a giant beside him about to fall. Crawl, and they know what you're saying makes sense at all.